What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Talofa, Marlo, Bulavanaka, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. It is Wednesday, November 13. I'm Kyle Evans. Thanks for tuning in for another edition live from Melbourne, the home of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Coming up today, female candidates fight for recognition as Papua New Guinea's local level government elections near a close after five referrals.
You know, our society still is yet to accept, recognize, and value the woman leadership.
Also, labour shortages impact Pacific agriculture as more and more workers jet off to Australia and New Zealand, and more than 180,000 people compete for 3,000 places under the Pacific Engagement Visa. All that and more coming up. I'm Kyle Evans. Let's get started. But first, we start in the Cook Islands, where there's growing concern over the breakdown of relations with New Zealand. It follows the suspension of $15 million Australian dollars worth of aid to the Cook Islands, in addition to $10 million earlier in the year. Details of the suspension were revealed after correspondence between New Zealand's Foreign Minister and Cook Islands were released to media under the Freedom of Information Act. To get an idea of how this has landed in the Cook Islands, we are joined by the Cook Islands News Editor, Rashnil Kumar. Rashnil, welcome back to the program.
Hey, kia ora.
So in total, just under 25 million Australian dollars or 30 million New Zealand dollars have been frozen. It's no small amount. How has news of the latest suspension been received within the Cook Islands government?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, so it's 29.8 million New Zealand dollars over the two financial years. So that is the current financial year and also the next financial year, which kicks in July next year. And this is direct budget support to the Cook Islands. The Cook Islands government hasn't been forthcoming lately about the impact that this would have. We have tried to reach out to them. The only response that we have received so far is that they're trying to work with the New Zealand officials at the official level and trying to mend the relationships that is at the center of this diplomatic fallout. So at the moment, we haven't had any official statement as to how this would impact the operations of the government.
Yes, those relations have really been soured in recent months. Just for listeners who might still be catching up, can you give us a quick recap on why this why relationships had soured after that deal with the Cook signed with China?
So basically, the center of this whole debacle has been the deals that the Cook Islands signed with China in February this year, and that included the joint action plan that was in 2025-2030, and that was done in February this year when Prime Minister Mark Brown made a state visit to China, and New Zealand were disappointed and concerned that they were not consulted as part of the joint centenary declaration that the two countries had signed in 2001, which according to New Zealand required Cook Islands and vice versa to consult each other when it came to anything to do with security or foreign affairs and defense. But according to the Cook Islands Prime Minister, the deal had nothing to do with security, and according to them, they don't see that they are required to discuss every detail because, you know, they have got the sovereignty to do their own foreign affairs that they have been doing it for the past so many years. And then obviously New Zealand went through the agreements that were signed, and in June this year they decided to pause the 18.2 million New Zealand dollars support, that is direct budget support to the Cook Islands, which affected the current financial year. And then last month, in a letter to Prime Minister Mark Brown, Foreign Minister Winston Peters also announced or revealed that they would be withholding the financial assistance that was earmarked for the next financial year.
I see. Now, you mentioned that the Cook Islands government haven't been open about how this money will impact the Cook Islands. But have you begun to see evidence on the ground of what impact the suspension of funds is having?
So the core sector budget, that's what we call it, the funding that has been paused, direct budget support, it normally covers areas like education, tourism and health. And what we did was we went around and started speaking to these sectors. Tourism, obviously, is not happy with what's happening lately. You know, I think about two-thirds of the visitors that come to the Cook Islands are from New Zealand. And the Cook Islands Tourism Industry Council this week told us that they want government to be more transparent and forthcoming with the information and who will be affected by this budget or by this funding pause. And we have also got comments from the Ministry of Health. The Secretary of Health has said that what they have done is they have started reprioritizing programs that have been affected by this core sector support funding pause, but they are still getting support from New Zealand through the Polynesian Health Corridors, which are the development assistance worth $35 million across the two financial years, 24-25 and 25-26, which will continue. So they still are getting support from there, but some of the funding, some of the areas that have been affected through the budget pause have been reprioritized to actually ensure there is minimal impact.
Yeah, well, tourism, health, and education are pretty major sectors, but yes. You mentioned that some has been reprioritized, and I know that there are some projects that still are being funded. So, which projects are they?
Yeah, I understand most of them are technical projects that Cook Islands has been working with New Zealand, and that will continue. We obviously we do have a major problem with NCDs. I'm not too sure whether that is an area that has been affected, and I believe that the normal referral programs that Cook Islands has with New Zealand will continue. So those are the areas that will continue from my understanding, but we haven't got final details in the areas that would be impacted and the areas that has been reprioritized.
I see. You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans and I'm chatting with Cook Islands News Editor Rashnil Kumar about New Zealand's further suspension of $15 million Australian dollars to the Cook Islands. Now, Rashnil, I understand it's funding which is sent directly to the government that has been
yes.
paused. Does that limit the government's power to an extent?
So, the core sector support is normally a direct budget support, which is basically decided by the government of the day on how they would like to spend it. So, obviously, I think New Zealand's point has been they don't want to give the New Zealand taxpayer money directly into the hands of Cook Island political leaders. That's what they told us earlier this week. And they want to make sure that the money that they give is accounted for and they are used for the right purposes. So obviously it would affect, I believe, their ambitions or their priority areas where they would want to spend and, you know, ensure governance in those areas. So definitely it would be a big hit for the government.
And also, I think some might argue that it almost sounds a little bit vindictive, almost like it feels a bit like a parent confiscating a toy from a child. Like, how do you expect Mark Brown to respond to this?
That's an interesting one. I think you may be aware that Prime Minister Mark Brown met with Prime Minister Luxon for an informal chat during the Pacific Islands Forum Leaders meeting in Honiara this year. And there were pictures circulating of both of them in happy mood, you could say. But the issue here is, I think the discussions are still ongoing at the officials level. There has been calls made by former politicians or other politicians or people or leaders, community leaders from here in New Zealand, for the leaders to meet and iron this out rather than leaving it to the official level, because it does take time and stuff. So we have also gone to New Zealand to ask what specifically Cook Islands needs to do to mend the relationship, because to us it seems like while talks are ongoing, but they're very slow. There's nothing forthcoming. I mean, New Zealand is saying that the talks are constructive, but they have decided to pause next year's funding. So that basically shows that there isn't anything fruitful coming out, or if there is, it's very slow. But New Zealand has got back to us. The Foreign Affairs Minister's Office has said that basically at the center of it, they want the trust that they feel has been broken through the deals that or the agreements that the Cook Islands have signed with China without proper consultation needs to be repaired before they can move forward. So it's left at the official levels at the moment to, I guess, iron this out. But there has been calls and encouragement for leaders of the two nations to come together and sit down and iron this out.
Yes, I have seen those calls. So, well, I guess, you know, in terms of ironing this out, you know, who do you think blinks first?
It's a really good question. I mean, I'm not too sure whether Prime Minister Mark Brown made any effort. We have been sending queries to his office. We haven't been getting much back, and I'm not sure whether those queries have been accepted. If he did make any by New Zealand in Parliament here, the opposition has been asking the Prime Minister to just apologise for what New Zealand seems like, you know, what we have done that is they feel it's wrong and just move on. But it's interesting. It will be interesting to see who's going to make the first step, but someone does have to take that step. Otherwise, this will drag on for years, and it will impact ultimately the people of this country.
Well, absolutely, and that's kind of where I want to end as well. I mean, you know, how has this affected Mark Brown's leadership, and could this, you know, impact his political future, particularly on the ground in the Cook Islands?
It's interesting times. I mean, next year is general elections, and obviously this would be amongst the thing that voters would be looking into while considering who they will vote in next year's elections. So I guess the onus is also on him and the government of the day to take some positive steps and those steps sooner to mend this relationship and resume the funding, which is very vital for those key areas that are being affected.
No, absolutely. Rashneel, fantastic insight. And that's all we've got time for. But thanks so much for joining us today on Pacific Beat.
No worries. Thank you, Kyle. Thank you very much.
That was Rashneel Kumar, Cook Islands news editor.
Join Natasha Metten for Sisters Let's Talk, a program that explores issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
When it comes to obesity prevention efforts, it's really important that it is a combination of diet, exercise, and intense counseling that comes with it.
Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, after five deferrals, Papua New Guinea's much-anticipated local-level government elections in Papua New Guinea is finally wrapping up. Starting in late October, more than 6,000 candidates are contesting 386 seats. As Belinda Cora reports, it's a massive logistical operation, and in some places, there's uncertainty over when all the results will be out.
When it comes to PNG politics, local governments serve those closest to the ground. But those running this government office face problems, accessing national funds. It's a problem Julie Vele knows all too well. She's standing for the seat of Hiri West, just outside of the capital, Port Moresby.
Being a landowner myself, impacted landowner, there's hardly much to show for with that big project in my backyard. So this was my biggest motivation that pushed me to put my hands up, because I've been a pioneer dealing with my landowner issues and the benefits that come with the project.
Julie is referring to the National LNG Gas Project within her area. These large-scale projects provide royalties that supplement funding to local level provided by the national government.
So we have had the benefits from that project alone has been in the millions. So it is one of the richest LNGs in Papua New Guinea. We've had IDG grants of about 18 million every year for the last 10 years. Plus we have had the development levy of 12 million every year. And so the incumbent has been seated in the council president seat for the last 15 years. And I've had to put up my hands to run in this race simply because I've observed that in this last 15 years of the existence of the PNG LNG project, and being a landowner myself, impacted landowner, there's hardly much to show for.
Vele is one of only four women contesting the Hiri West seat, but it's an uphill battle. One of the big barriers is culture.
We have patrilineal societies. Most of us candidates are running in these societies where, you know, our society still is yet to accept, recognize, and value the woman leadership. And so it's been an uphill battle for all of us female candidates.
An hour's flight away in the Southern Highlands province, Grace Wong is looking after the LLG election there. She is the acting election manager for the province that's often been a hotbed of election violence.
But otherwise, so far, so good. We haven't encountered a lot of problems, no major issues. The precedents that the LNG election has set now, it's looking good for 2027. And I appeal to all our leaders in the province, take the same approach when it comes to the election in future, like in 2027. But for now, we did our polling and counting, we did well in its ward.
Wong says one problem that keeps hampering elections in PNG is the out-of-date common roll.
So the time frame was only 1 month. So within that one month, we were doing polling and counting as well. So we had no time for us to do display and also go back to poll. So we had to prioritize polling first. So what the best advice that, you know, I can give them, allow the people to poll first. And then by next year, we'll do the roll display for the 2025 roll. And they'll go by those rolls and check whether their names are not in, or there's been their names were misplaced or misspelled. Those won't be corrected in 2026.
She says often it's a challenge to get the voter list updated. In most areas, election officials have declared winners following counting. In the Southern Highlands, only one out of close to 100 female candidates has won seat. In Hiri West, Julie Vele and her team are still waiting for counting to start and for official results to be announced.
Communication was really lacking in this entire exercise. The messages from the ARO to the candidates really poor. Another example is like now. We've brought all the ballot boxes. There's no storage area here. We don't know how long. We've started very late. We don't know how long this counting is going to go on. Apart from that, we were really handicapped. We were never given any common roll, the updated version or even the old version to work with, you know, knowing that it's a numbers game. We were never given any common roll copy. We were just told that if we wanted a copy, we had to go to get a court order and obtain it.
Hiri West candidate Julie Vella ending that report from Belinda Cora in Papua New Guinea. Pacific Beat. Welcome back to Pacific Beat and to the high seas now, where over the past few years, National Geographic has been assisting Pacific Island governments in its education sector through its Pristine Seas project. As part of the project, the National Geographic research vessel MV Argo visited Pacific Island nations, offering tours to students from local schools. Finau Finua spoke to Chris Hines, education lead for National Geographic's Pristine Seas.
on every ocean expedition that we do, we bring young students on ship. We call it ship day. And we get about 120 students on board to meet the scientists, to learn about the expedition, to learn about the ecosystems. And they get to see all the cool technology that we have on board. So we have a submersible, we have remotely operated vehicles, we have deep sea cameras. And one thing we constantly hear from students after they get off the ship is like, I want to be a scientist, or what can I do to help preserve the ocean or help preserve some of the fish that we saw. So it's really cool to be able to see kind of students thinking about the connections between ocean science and career pathways as well.
What are the biggest challenges you notice in the Pacific Islands in terms of the education?
Absolutely. So some of the of course, resources is a significant challenge throughout the Pacific, but a significant one is what we hear a lot on our National Geographic Pristine Seas Ocean Expeditions is that we actually share contextualized resources and share contextualized data with communities, with governments, with educators and students. And so students actually see what's under the water in their own environment. And I think that's a significant piece that a lot of educators tell us that they're missing, is like contextualized science, underwater photos and videos that they might be missing, so they can actually make those connections from theory to action and actually better teach in really some cool ways around ocean literacy and ocean science here in the Pacific.
Could you tell us about the importance of climate action and how it affects the marine the marine environment?
Throughout the Pacific, we've been to 10 or 11 different Pacific countries and engage in ocean conservation and science throughout those countries. And one thing we continuously see is a lot of the coral reefs are in a not healthy state, are unhealthy. So they've either been degraded through overfishing or through climate impacts. And we're really seeing that consistently throughout the Pacific. There's very few instances. There's a couple in the Marshall Islands that we've seen that are in very healthy states, such as Bikar and Bokak, but a lot of coral reefs and ocean ecosystems are in very unhealthy states right now. And so that's one of the things that we're trying to get across, both at the regional level, at the national level, and global level as well, is that a lot of the ocean ecosystems are not healthy right now. And so we're trying to get stakeholders as well as young people and educators to take action, because the global warming issue is a real concern both for ocean ecosystems and communities themselves.
That was Chris Hines, Education Lead for National Geographic's Pristine Seas, and he was speaking there with Finau Fanua. It is that time of the morning where we take a look at what's making headlines around the Pacific region. And to do that, I'm joined in the studio by our producer today, Finau Fanua. Finau, welcome.
Good morning, Carl.
Now, let's start off with an update from Papua New Guinea's Western Highlands province, where violence has forced the closure of Goroka University. Can you tell us more?
According to the Post Courier and the national newspaper in Papua New Guinea, 24 buses and police escorts have evacuated nearly 2,000 students from Goroka on Tuesday. These are students from the University of Goroka. Nearly 7,000 students in general have left the campus. And all of this is in response to the mayhem at the University of Goroka campus on Sunday, when a fight broke out between members of the public and students, leaving more than 50 people injured. It's the fourth major outbreak of violence between students and the public. There's conflicting reports about why this is happening. One student was killed earlier this year while he was on his way to campus.
Yeah, it's very sad indeed. I have seen some of those images and footage online, and it certainly is very confronting. To Vanuatu now, where the Ombudsman's Office is having to pay $500,000 Vatu in damages. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, Vanuatu Daily Post reports the country's Supreme Court ordered the Office of the Ombudsman to pay $500,000 Vatu. That's the equivalent of $6,500 Australian dollars in damage for executing an unlawful search warrant against the former general manager of the Vanuatu National Provident Fund, His name is Pamud Archery. And this incident occurred in August 2019 when officers of the Ombudsman Office and police conducted the search at the Vanuatu National Provident Fund premises using the warrant from the Magistrates Court instead of the Supreme Court as stipulated under law. And the Supreme Court ruled the Ombudsman Office executed the search warrants obtained from the wrong court.
And just finally, all 10 teams have now been confirmed for the Rugby League World Cup next year, I understand.
Yep. New Zealand, Australia, Tonga, Samoa, Fiji, Papua New Guinea, France, England, the Cook Islands, and Lebanon. These are the 10 teams for next year's Rugby League World Cup. And they were all confirmed following the final qualifier on Sunday. That was between the Cook Islands and South Africa. The Cook Islands trumped them 58-6. So next year's tournament is going to be hosted by Australia and Papua New Guinea. It was originally supposed to be hosted by France, but that was cancelled. Elsewhere, the women's and wheelchair tournaments will both feature 8 teams. Fiji will compete in their first ever women's tournament after defeating Nigeria in a qualifier last month. The wheelchair tournament will be defended by England, who defeated France in the 2021 final. They'll be joined by Australia, New Zealand, Wales, the US, Ireland and Scotland. It's going to be an interesting World Cup. A lot of quality players in all those teams, even the minor teams like Cook Islands and Lebanon.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned Lebanon. You know, there's been some great Lebanese rugby league players over the years, starting back with your Hazem El Mazaris and your more recent players like Mitchell Moseses and guys like that. Look, there's certainly a lot of talent there. Did you watch the Pacific Championships for now?
Yes, I did. It was a great game. A lot of controversy. I've seen a lot of someone's complaining about decisions by the ref in that game.
Well, I know you're from Tonga, but you also lived a number of years in New Zealand. Who were you going for in that grand final?
I was going for New Zealand. Just got too many text messages every day after Tonga lost to Samoa. Just roasting the Tongan team for not delivering.
I respect your honesty, Finau. I got to admit, I was going for New Zealand as well. Not because I have anything against Samoa. They're a great team, but I really like that New Zealand team. They're very talented. And I honestly think they could challenge Australia.
Absolutely.
Next year.
No, but we even will see. To Samoa. They're a threat in next year for sure.
Oh, it's going to be fantastic. Finau, thanks very much for bringing us those stories today.
Cheers.
That was Finau Fanua with our news wrap. It's Thursday, November 13. I'm Kyle Evans and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. And if you're just tuning in, we began in the Cook Islands today where New Zealand have suspended a further $15 million worth of aid funding. Meanwhile, we heard about the fight for recognition for female candidates as Papua New Guinea's local level government elections finally near to close after 5 referrals.
Most of us candidates are running in these societies where, you know, our society still is yet to accept, recognize and value the woman leadership. And so it's been an uphill battle for all of us female candidates.
Stick around because still to come, we'll look at how labour shortages are impacting Pacific agriculture as more and more workers jet off to Australia and New Zealand.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, Pacific governments have consistently raised concerns over the problem of labour shortages caused by the seasonal worker scheme in Australia and New Zealand. This includes the agriculture sector, which serves as a vital food system for villages across the Pacific region. It's a topic that's being studied by University of the Sunshine Coast Associate Professor Sili Molusamanosi. The ABC's Lucy Cooper spoke to her earlier.
A lot of our seasonal workers are able-bodied men and women who leave our communities and who leave our workforce to either come to New Zealand or come to Australia because there are better pays, better opportunities there for them. When they leave, the communities that they leave behind, they'll be by majority comprised of, you know, the aged and the younger people. And so the role of producing food at the household level and the community level falls to our aged communities and to our younger people. And so food production is impacted in that space. In addition, we've also got laborers who are leaving the food production commercial scale companies in Samoa and so and across the Pacific. And so these commercial companies' ability to access labor to support their food production is also impacted. And so these are some of the nuances that are affecting food production at home when we've got seasonal workers leaving for better opportunities in New Zealand and Australia, because these are the major schemes that are supporting seasonal workers coming from the Pacific into New Zealand and Australia. There is no question that the seasonal worker scheme also positively impacts our Pacific communities. It contributes to employment rates. It contributes to our GDP through the remittances and the economy that they bring back to the Pacific. So we're wanting to support food production at the local level, but we need to weave in that social and cultural lens to it to support what can we do to empower people who are left behind to build and to resuscitate their food production capabilities. And at the same time, we're also wanting to leverage the capacities and the skills that our seasonal workers gain from New Zealand and Australia to support food production at home. So they often come to New Zealand and Australia to work in orchards. We don't necessarily have strong orchards in the Pacific, but there are skills around good agricultural practices, around pruning, that could be adopted across to the Pacific. But we need to understand what the local context might be to sort of see how these benefits could be brought across to support food production at the Pacific level and region.
Climate change is affecting everyday life in the Pacific. Is the region, you know, equipped or in a strong enough place to also tackle it on a food level?
I think there are a lot of challenges that we have to navigate. So looking at capability, the skill set of the people that we have working in this space, there are areas where they would like more capacity building in. There's resource things, so looking at funding to support research that needs to happen to determine what interventions work to support food production and food security in the face of climate change. But at the same time, I want to acknowledge that there are a lot of donors and a lot of people who are coming in to provide support on the ground. So we've got the Australian government, we've got the New Zealand government, and then we've also got other international players like the World Bank, like ADB, like EFED, all wanting to provide that support to the Pacific. And I think what we do need is to better coordinate all of these efforts to make sure that we're learning from each other and to make sure that we're not reinventing the wheel in some of the spaces that we work in. So acknowledging that there are challenges, but also at the same time, really want to take my hat off to everyone else who are working in this space to support the Pacific and becoming more food secure and more climate resilient.
That was Associate Professor Sisi'i Molemau Samasoni speaking to the ABC's Lucy Cooper. Switching gears now, the United States has positioned the world's largest aircraft carrier in waters near Latin America. Analysis say it points to an imminent escalation with Venezuela, with the US military using a variety of drones, gunships and fighter jets to strike alleged drug trafficking boats in the Pacific Ocean in recent weeks. Venezuela says it's determined to defend itself, carrying out a new phase of military exercises, as Tanya Dedranos reports.
Broadcast on Venezuelan public television, the National Bolivarian Armed Forces carry out extensive drills across the country as part of a plan dubbed Independencia 200. Vladimir Padrino López is the Venezuelan defense minister.
Amamos profundamente la paz.
We deeply love peace. We do not want war here, nor anywhere in the world. But if they come to touch Venezuela, well, they will find us here. walk through the streets, walk through the communal militia units, and there you will see a people determined to defend this homeland to the death.
It's a pointed message to the United States, which has carried out more than a dozen strikes on alleged drug trafficking vessels near the Venezuelan coast since September, killing more than 70 people, despite providing little evidence to prove the allegations. There have been repeated questions over the legality of the attacks. UN spokesperson Farhan Haq.
The Secretary General supports the views of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, who has made it clear that the airstrikes are in violation of international human rights law.
CNN is now reporting that the United Kingdom is no longer sharing intelligence with the US about suspected drug trafficking vessels in the Caribbean because it does not want to be complicit in US military strikes and believes the attacks are illegal. It attributed the information to sources familiar with the matter. Mark Kansian is a retired Marine colonel and senior advisor for the Defence and Security Department at the Centre for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. He says it's possible the UK has made this move, given questions over the use of force.
The US is arguably its closest ally, so to step back here would be a significant statement by the UK.
Responding to a request for comment, a Department of War official told The World Today, "We don't discuss intelligence matters." The British Embassy in Washington was also contacted for comment. The vessel strikes are perhaps less worrisome for Venezuela than the significant US military buildup in the Caribbean.
It goes beyond what would be needed for counter-drug operations and is large enough to constitute a force that could attack Venezuela, either the Maduro regime or the cartels on land.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has repeatedly accused Donald Trump of seeking to overturn his government, but President Trump has played down accusations of seeking a Venezuelan regime change. The US Navy has confirmed the world's largest aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald Ford, has now arrived in the region. Mark Kansian says it's a consequential move.
It's such a powerful and scarce military resource, pulling it out of Europe and the Mediterranean is a strong strategic statement by the Trump administration about how important the Caribbean is.
How likely do you think a further escalation is?
I think that the possibility of a missile strike on Venezuela is very likely. The U.S. has put together a force that is capable of doing that. The other thing is that as the United States has built up its forces and capabilities in the Caribbean, there's a use or lose element to it. The United States is like an archer who has pulled back the bow, and eventually you either have to let the arrow go or stand down.
Last month, President Trump said he'd authorized the CIA to conduct covert operations in Venezuela and has suggested he was weighing the possibility of strikes inside the country, though administration officials told lawmakers last week such action is not currently planned.
That was Tania Dendridos with that report.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and the stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll also bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to football, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursdays at 4 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. There's only 3,000 spaces available per year, but more than 180,000 people have applied for the Pacific Engagement Visa ballot. The visa is providing Pacific Islanders a shot at permanent residency in Australia, and the scheme has only grown in popularity. One person who's been keeping a close eye on the PEV is Natasha Turia, a researcher at the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University, and she joins us on the line from Canberra. Natasha, welcome to the program.
Good morning through Evan, and thank you for having me on the program.
Not a problem at all. Now, you've been keeping a close eye on tabs in the Pacific visa since it was first introduced. Why is it so popular and growing even more so?
Well, I mean, as I've already said before, there's a shortage of jobs across the Pacific, high youth bulge, so obviously there's more opportunities in Australia that would make the PEV an attractive migration pathway. in a recent article that Professor House and myself published on the DevPol blog, when we counted the total number of Pacific Visa Engagement ballot applications by primary applicants, and this is including the total number of dependents they may have listed, there was an overall increase of 9%. So Pacific-wide, there's still, you know, high interest for the PEV.
So where are the majority of applications coming from?
This year, Timor-Leste took top spot with over 56,000 PEV ballot registrations. And second was Fiji with over 47,000. And third was PNG with 30,317. So Timor-Leste was the standout source country, almost doubling its total PEV registrations from last year.
Interesting. And how are the applicants selected? Like things like age, education, profession a factor? Like what are assessors weighing up when they're going through these applications?
Well, the PEV is designed for a random ballot selection. So it doesn't discriminate for, you know, your education background or even your gender at the moment. The only eligibility criteria is that you must be 18 to 45 years of age and hold a passport to one of the participating 11 countries across the Pacific.
I see. And do we have any data as to why Timor-Leste is so highly represented, particularly when, you know, the population of PNG is so much bigger?
Well, I mean, for Timor-Leste, there's already existing data showing an increase in out-migration out of Timor-Leste. 33% of them would like to live overseas. So it would make sense for a higher increase in PEV ballot registrations, particularly from Timor-Leste in this round. We just didn't anticipate it to be an absolute increase.
That's really interesting. So which country has the highest success rate in terms of securing a PEV?
I think what we need to know first is that the success rate is based on total ballot registrations to country quota allocations. So the chances of winning a PEV were highest for Nauru at 10% and then for PNG at 4%. So conversely, the higher number of PEV ballot registrations to the actual country ballot allocations sounds a bit confusing. Mm. But if, say, for instance, Fiji has a country quota of 300 and they had 56,000 PEV ballot registrations, that means the chances of Fijian nationals winning the PEV is lower. So this is why we see Timor-Leste now has a 0.5% chance of, they had the lowest success rate.
I see. It's all starting to become clear now. That makes sense. So I understand there's been a few challenges. It hasn't all been smooth sailing since it was rolled out. What's some of the challenges that applicants have faced when applying for the PEV?
Well, unfortunately, the issue of securing a formal 12-month job offer still persists. We had already published a recent article last month restating the difficulties in achieving or at least securing a job offer. And we already knew when they were going to launch the visa that the hardest process or part of the visa process would be securing the job offer, because you can't get the visa without the job offer. But then employers also don't recognize the visa before they can actually give you a job offer. So applicants are still left in a, you know, catch-22 kind of position. So we still have this issue. And we did report last month that although there's been an increase in the total number of visas that have been granted, so of the 3,000 last year, we had, as of July, 1,180 visas granted. It's been, you know, a slow rate of increase of application to visa conversion, and a large part of that is because people are finding it really difficult to secure that job offer. And this is going to be the same issue for this new cohort for 2025.
Is there a high rate of awareness or education around the visa among Australian employers? Like, do they know what it is for the most part?
From anecdotes from people who've already won the visa, they don't feel that employers in Australia actually understand how the visa works. So when they apply for jobs and they ask them, you know, do you have a visa, and they show them the PEV selection letter, they said, oh, no, we don't know what that is. We actually need a visa on hand. So this already illustrates that there isn't enough awareness among Australian employers around how the visa works, so that they don't ask these questions to PEV applicants.
Yeah, that would be really frustrating for applicants, given, you know, I can only imagine the paperwork they've got to go through all to have it submitted to, you know, to find that your employer's got no idea about it. I mean, is there anything that the government can do to, I'm not sure, like raise that awareness?
So the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade have contracted Pacific Engagement Visa Support Service. So they've got representation across all 11 participating countries to support PEV winners connect to employers. So they do provide information sessions, seminars on, you know, like how to do your resume, apply for jobs, and they do provide them with support that only connects them to the employers. They can't actually guarantee a job. So, I mean, that's the only kind of arrangement that Australia has set up for PEV winners offshore. But then at the end of the day, it's still the applicant's responsibility to reach out to employers and then really try their luck to get a job offer. And, you know, it's been 1 year already, and this issue of the job offer has not been, to my opinion, has not been fixed or resolved enough to at least achieve more than, you know, close to 90% success rate for the PEV since 2024 last year.
Would that issue about the job offer, would that be the biggest source of feedback that you get from applicants?
That is the biggest issue I get from many applicants. There's not one applicant. I think there's only been maybe five I know of. This is only for PNG. I would not know for the other Pacific Island countries. But, you know, it's incredibly difficult for them to get a job. I get emails, messages saying, you know, some people have been trying for, like, especially the ones from 2024, they're still trying to look for a job offer. They've had so many rejections from many different employers, you know, over 20,000 different, you know, applications. And it's a very, I mean, mentally exhausting process to remain a job seeker for the next, you know, 12 months. And then I'm afraid of how this is going to impact on this current cohort of 2025 and then every subsequent cohort from this year onwards.
Yeah, no, I can only imagine. Natasha, let's leave it there because we are running out of time. But no, look, some really, really interesting insight. And I want to thank you for coming on Pacific Beat today.
No worries. Thank you very much, Evan.
That was Natasha Turia, a researcher at the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University. And that does bring us to the end of Pacific Beat today. Time to take a look back at our main story. New Zealand has suspended 2 years of aid payments worth $30 million to the Cook Islands, signalling deteriorating relations between the two countries.
Yeah, I think New Zealand's point has been they don't want to give the New Zealand taxpayer money directly into the hands of Cook Island political leaders. And they want to make sure that the money that they give is accounted for and they are used for the right purposes.
We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned on ABC Radio Australia, though, because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nija Daily. You'll find all our top stories on our website. Just type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into your search engine or via the ABC Pacific page. My name's Kyle Evans. Have a fantastic day.